Welcome back to Radio Times in Review, a new show where we dig into the archives and find the best interviews from Radio Times past. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We kick off today's show with a conversation with author and ethnographer Yaba Blay. The Drexel University Professor of Africana Studies joined me in 2013 when her book One Drop was released. It's an examination of the different ways people identify themselves racially, specifically within the traditional Black community. Through a series of 70 interviews accompanied by very personal photographs, Blay's book challenges the Black-white dichotomy. It also provides insight into how people from all points on the racial spectrum see themselves. Let's listen. Your book is called One Drop, and yes. Of course this is a very loaded word in this country with deep history. What does that mean, One Drop?
The title is a nod to this age-old rule, if you will, the One Drop rule, which was a law turned social rule. And so by 1925, most states in this country had some form or another of this rule. And so the One Drop rule comes to define Blackness as anyone with literally one drop, as little as 1/32nd, meaning one person five generations back. If that person is of African descent, that makes you in this moment Black.
Would a blood test even reveal if, you know, someone's racial heritage?
It wasn't about blood then.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, it's just about mapping out the family tree.
Well, in fact, you include something in your book, What Are You? And it's a colonial Louisiana definitions. I'm going to read the definitions. You've got Negro. Then you've got Socotra, 7/8 Negro. You've got Griff, G-R-I-F-F-E, 3/4 Negro. Mulatto, half Negro. Quadroon, quarter Negro. Octoroon, 1/8 Negro. Quinteroon, 1/36 Negro. And then passe a blanc, or I guess passing for white.
Yes. And it's just to show, because, you know, within this country, the one drop rule, we see that kind of Black or white kind of thing. You know, one drop makes you Black. But in places like New Orleans and Charleston, you had more of a range. And so it wasn't just cut and dry, one drop, you're Black. It was all of these gradations. And with each one of these gradations came differing levels of privilege in the community.
And some people, of course, then could pass into the white community.
Yeah,
unbeknownst.
Yeah, and passing is an interesting concept,
it
you
is.
Know, in that it really speaks to the idea, and I always tell my students that none of this is real, right? It's about people's perceptions. It's about people's definitions. It's about, you know, he or she who names has the power. And so what's interesting when we talk about Black racial identity for so long, particularly in this country, it hasn't been Black people who have been defining our identities. It's been the white society. And their investment in defining our identity had much to do with maintaining power and isolating power within a particular group.
But what's interesting, and I think your book speaks to this, which is these are all people in this book who call themselves some version of Black. And yet I have to say, as a white person looking at them, sometimes they look Black, sometimes they look like something else.
And it's the question, what does Blackness look like?
Exactly.
So what is that? And so for me, it's really about challenging that. And again, starting with myself, coming to Philadelphia from New Orleans, I had my own ideas about what Blackness was based upon my experience in New Orleans. And so for me, in my experience, most people who, and listen to the language, had the option not to be Black, or, you know, had the privilege to not be Black, chose not to be Black. They right. were Creole, or they were these other things. And so coming to the Northeast, coming to a city like Philadelphia and then visiting places like New York, where I'm seeing people who look very much like folks I grew up with who are like, I'm Black, or I'm Afro this, or I'm that. And so I was intrigued, like, well, what does that mean? And why would you want to be Black? Listen to it. Why would you want to be Black if you don't have to be?
Mm.
And so this conversation with folks in this book is about people who, above and beyond any legal designation or any drops, they're saying, I'm Black for all of these other reasons. And this is what Blackness means to me, despite what I look like, or maybe even because of what I look like. And so it really challenges us to think about Blackness bigger than what it looks like.
Do you think the 60s had anything to do with this, the sort of Black is beautiful idea, which is to people growing their hair and saying, I'm a Black person and this is what I look like?
I mean, I think the Black is beautiful movement was the kind of public announcement and the moment where the rest of the world got to know that we were proud of ourselves. But I think we've always been proud. I think we've always thought Black is beautiful, but the Black is beautiful movement was more of a political movement to say, now it's time for you to see it too.
But what's so difficult, I guess, about this whole notion of skin color is that so many Black slave women, you know, were raped by the white owner slash master, their children are then born, and perhaps they get some kind of increased status, but it was a birth out of the violation of slavery.
And that's why it was so important for me to map out this history in the introduction of the book before getting into the stories, because you know, we all know that many people think that race doesn't matter in this moment. And so there's so many people who have no clue about the history of race in this country. So the one drop rule is coming out of anti-miscegenation America. The one drop rule is a way to discourage the mixing of the races. And what it says is that, you know, Marty, you can be a white woman and fall in love with an enslaved African man and have his child, but no matter what, your child is going to be enslaved. So no matter what you do, you are the only person that's white in this situation. Even your child can be enslaved, so don't do it.
Well, you even say that the white abolitionists or the abolitionists often used light-skinned slaves or even children as part of their campaign against slavery.
Right. It was part of the propaganda. And so they weren't saying, let's abolish slavery necessarily because it's wrong. Look at these enslaved people. They were saying, look at this white-looking child. Even this child could be enslaved, which is an affront on whiteness as a whole. And so if we want to protect whiteness, we need to protect this child. And so it had less to do about the institution of enslavement as it did with the idea that someone who looked white could be enslaved.
And they even talked about white slaves and black slaves, right? I mean, those are the words that were used.
And that, and really that was a, in a space like New Orleans, for example, where someone who quote unquote look white could be enslaved, everyone in that space did not consider that person white because of these different categorizations. The abolitionists are coming out of the North, and so they're looking at these enslaved children and saying there's no way these children could be enslaved or black because of how they conceive of whiteness. And so it really even shows in terms of locale, and we still see this in America, based upon what region you're in, you can have different ideas of what blackness is or should look like.
Well, as someone who writes questions for a living, I was interested in the questions that you came up with, which became the kind of basis for this book. How do you identify racially, culturally, and what do people usually assume about your identity? Do people question your blackness? So you had very specific questions you wanted to have answered.
Yeah, I mapped those questions out as a guide. For the most part, each one of these interviews really functioned as a conversation, and it really opened up a lot of interesting things for most people. And, you know, it wasn't a standard Q&A, but just these are my guiding questions to try and get some idea of what their identity meant to them.
Anything surprise you? Or did you see patterns or trends in here?
What surprised me, and maybe it didn't surprise me. I think the surprising part was just having a voice. But I've done work on colorism for years, and so I've always looked at it from one direction, and that's the disadvantages that come with having dark skin. There was always something eating at me, thinking there has to be another side to this without necessarily knowing what that other side is. But I think if anything, particularly interested in the ways the conversations with women went. A lot of stuff came out about the tenuous relationship that happens between dark and browner skinned women and lighter skinned women. And really this idea that for the women I spoke to, at least, they're not necessarily walking around flaunting a privilege or saying I'm better than you. But that's oftentimes a lot of the assumptions that we make when we see them. Or to have a woman say to me, you know, if I could give the privilege to you, do you want it? Like, what do you want me to do? Like, all I really want is to be seen as your sister. I didn't ask for this skin color. And so it really opened up a lot in terms of even personal connections with folks.
Well, I thought it was interesting of the many people that you talked to, they had their own sort of unique way of describing themselves.
Yes.
Black in certain instances, biracial in certain instances, mixed. There was a gentleman that called himself Appalachian African American. There was the Black Latina. This is Lina Delgado de Torres, a woman that called herself a Jamaican, which I guess is Jamaica and American, Afro-Cuban. I mean, these are words that people use to describe themselves.
Yes, and for me, it was very important to honor their own naming of themselves, because again, the power comes in the naming, you know, and so they all have various stories. But it was interesting to me also that they had thought critically about the names that they would use to call themselves, which is not something I think many people do. Many of us just take the language that is given to us without necessarily thinking about what that means. And so I had lots of interesting conversations about folk who will say, I'm black, I'm not African American, or I'm African American, I'm not black. And so even thinking about the politics of those terms that some people use interchangeably.
I mentioned Lena, and she describes herself as Black Latina. She says, my mother's parents were from Jamaica and Cuba, my father from Spain, but I'm not biracial. I'm a Black Latina.
Yes. And she speaks, she's also a professor. And she speaks very critically of the language of biracial. You know, she talks about the language assigning an identity that doesn't align with her lived experience, that she's not split down the middle, half black, half white. And so what does it really mean to be biracial? And so, again, interesting conversations about the language that we use to identify.
You also talk about the Plessy versus Ferguson case, mm-hmm. which, of course, was before the U.S. Supreme Court, essentially enshrined separate but equal. Plessy actually passed as white, mm-hmm. so he bought his ticket mm-hmm. for the train as a white man, but then he revealed himself to be a black man.
Yes, and it was calculated. You know, it was for the purpose of bringing this conversation to the fore, that if I look white, and you didn't ask me any questions, and I could have sat in this first class seating, but I am black. Like, what does this? They were really challenging race, period, at this point in time. We don't necessarily learn about the case that way.
No.
We learn about it in terms of separate but equal. But this group of African descended folks in Louisiana, they were actually challenging the courts on race, on the classification of race, and saying that it doesn't mean anything. We're human beings way back then.
You interviewed a woman named Angela Griggs, born in 1908
yes.
in Fayetteville, Georgia. She says, "My father's father was white and his mother was dark. My father's father owned the sawmill. He never claimed my father as his son, but he did see to it that we were taken care of. My father never laid on us about no yellow, no light skin, or no white, or no passing, or none of it." And she's basically saying, he said to us, "We're Negroes. We're black.
Yeah.
We're not going to pass."
No, and for him, you know, what I appreciate about her story, he said to his children very frankly, "Do you see my mother? Do you see her skin color? If you abandon blackness, you abandon her." And again, it's about the historical moment, because what she also recognized was that her grandmother was being taken advantage of, she was being abused, and that if anything, she needed to align herself with that as a sense of pride, but also as a sense of support.
How much do you think the fact that we are a much more racially diverse country and continue to be beyond just black and white, just looking around, it's just a much more diverse country, does that change, you think, how we operate racially or how we self-identify or even identify others? Or maybe there's more of like, what are you? Mm-hmm. Because everyone's kind of this mix of genealogies.
I think the shift is coming with the kind of shift with the policing of identity, if that makes sense. And so the one-drop rule happened in a time where you didn't have any other options. You were white or you were black, period. Those were your two options. Pick one. Now we're in a space where people are given more options. Mm-hmm. Check more than one. Check all that apply. Fill in other. In this moment where we give people option, it seems that people are taking the option, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So I actually question whether we're actually becoming more diverse, mixed. I think the mixing is always taking place.
Right.
It's just a matter of what we were naming that.
You just heard my 2013 conversation with Drexel University Professor of Africana Studies, Yaba Blay, who joined me to discuss her book, One Drop. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moskowain. When we get back from this break, we'll hear my conversation with Jacob Tomsky, author of the hotel industry expose, Heads in Beds. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moskowain. When I read Jacob Tomsky's memoir, Heads in Beds, it forever changed the way I view the hotel experience. For instance, I always wash the water glass in my hotel room before I use it. The best-selling expose sheds light on the seediest and hidden aspects of the hotel industry. It also uncovers some of the questionable practices of hotel staff and their patrons, and even reflects on the nature of humanity itself. Jacob Tomsky, a hospitality industry veteran, joined me in 2013 to discuss his book. Let's listen. I'm wondering, after a decade of working in the hotel industry, having a variety of different jobs, does anything surprise you about human nature anymore?
Not really. I got past the point of being surprised, and then actually got to the point of maybe being bored with it, even when it came out in the form of anger and, you know, infidelities and what have you. It was an amazing position to hold, to see so much difference, and people flip on a dime, and people one way one day and one way the next day. It's an amazing position.
You got your first job in New Orleans, actually working as a valet, right? A garage valet?
That's correct. Parking cars.
What's interesting, whether you're parking cars or working in a hotel, they're all, of course, those things that happen behind the scenes that the owner of a car or someone staying in a hotel are not aware of. I know sometimes when I'm picking up my car at a garage and you can hear that sound of the wheels squealing as those cars are coming around the circle to get down there, I always wonder, what the heck is going on back there? Can you clue us in?
Yeah, we're speeding fast. Sometimes you're in a luxury car and you kind of want to see what it can do. Also, you know, sometimes the turns are tight and you're bringing it to speed, but you're kind of in an interesting position because if you drive very slowly and carefully, the guests begin to complain that it's taking forever for their car to come down and they're on their way to the airport and they're going to miss their flight. And if you start burning tire, then they start complaining that they're hearing tire squealing. So it's a delicate balance up in that garage.
And there's a whole etiquette about tips.
You know, one of the tips that I would suggest is that you give a gratuity up front to the valet parker before he or she pulls away your vehicle, if possible. That way, at least you're on their mind when they get into the garage alone. But yeah, usually a dollar or two. And definitely when you come down, a dollar or two is quite nice because there's a lot of running involved and we're in charge of your vehicle. So it's good to be a little generous there.
And when a fancy car comes in, is there a temptation to test drive it somewhere?
Sure, especially, you know, when I was working at the restaurant, the parking deck was actually around the corner, so we got to take it on the streets for a little bit instead of just going right up into the garage. And, you put a young kid behind the wheel of a beautiful vehicle, right. You know, the foot's going to go on the pedal and you're going to want to get at it a little bit.
And what's the most beautiful vehicle you drove?
I think it was a BMW Z3, I believe.
Nice.
Those little tiny BMWs were great because you could really feel the road. You know, Lexuses and things like that were so smooth. It felt like you were driving a yacht. So especially, you know, I worked in a really tight garage with tiny turns. So having a little vehicle with a lot of go to it and you could really feel the road, I really enjoyed driving that car.
Well, and the hotel, which you don't name, but you call the Bellevue, is where you worked in New York. Have people in New York figured out where you worked?
No. A lot of guesses. There's so many hotels, even when I used, you know, when I was working there and people would say, oh, what hotel do you work in? And I'd say, I'd know before I even said the name that they're going to be like, oh, I've never heard of it unless it's one of the, you know, the giants. But yeah, no one's guessed correctly yet.
Well, we can see what our listeners can come up with here. But you've worked at high-end hotels. I mean, would it be fair to say that guests at high-end hotels get treated very, very well, at least to their face?
When people pay a higher rate, they're going to expect a higher service.
And you say, and this should not surprise anyone, that celebrities are the worst.
Oh, yeah. Well, they run the gamut, just like every human being. You never really know what you're going to get. I mean, I've had divas that wanted everything in the room white, and, you know, we had to get rid of the red throw pillows and black out the windows and had, like, full-length mirrors. And then I had, you know, a hip-hop celebrity that all he wanted was the television to be PlayStation compatible. We would have bought him a PlayStation and provided him with whatever games he wanted, but he was just wanted to make sure that he could hook up his own. So it's, you know, you never know what you're going to get.
In my intro, I said that if you're staying in room 1212 in New York City, you have made someone very angry. Can you explain why?
Basically, what happens is you got people checking in and people still do not know that you need to dial out. So they will pick up any room phone at any time and they will dial 1212 trying to call a local number, and hence 1212's phone will ring day and night nonstop with people who don't know how to dial out. So I would use that room. Otherwise, it's a beautiful room, but I would use that room as a slight form of punishment if I needed to.
And
that's going to work anywhere you can take the area code
and put a one in front of it
and have it sound like a valid room number in a hotel. That's going to be the situation.
Well, your book is full of amazing stories about people doing amazing things. But broadly speaking, are most people pretty well behaved when they come to a hotel?
I would say maybe 60% of people are quite normal and they're just, you know, ready to, you know, be nice and polite and enjoy their stay. But then again, you know, that leaves a good 40% that just go crazy. Mm-hmm. There's something primal that happens when you put somebody in a position where they feel like they're in this room that they don't care about and they're surrounded by servants, and they end up treating the room and the people around them in ways that they would never treat people in their normal life or their rooms at home or a friend's house. It's just people really, you know, that's part of the hotel life. And that's part of the joy of staying in a hotel is that feeling of freedom and letting go and not caring about these items and having everything there for you and being waited on hand and foot. It really does affect people. It goes to people's heads sometimes. you know, it's part of what hotels are all about, and that's why they're there, and that's what we do.
Indeed, and you describe it's almost, well, certainly vivid and bordering on disgusting about working as a housekeeping manager and looking in people's rooms and the kind of mess and just yuck that they had left for the housekeeper to clean up.
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of bloodborne pathogens, a lot of fluids, a lot of things left around that you wouldn't really want to leave around when you think about the fact that a stranger is going to be in there. People just get in there and just go bananas.
But what's interesting is that people working in a hotel do have a way of exacting, I don't know if it's revenge exactly, for everything, but I have to say, having read your book, I will never drink from a glass of water in my hotel room ever again. Can you explain to our listeners why?
Well, that one, I mean, we do have ways of revenge from mild to severe methods. But that's actually the housekeepers are responsible for cleaning those minibar glasses, and they actually are not provided with dish soap. So they'll clean them with what they have available, and that's either going to be shampoo. You fill up the sink with hot water, put the shampoo in there, and then soak the glasses, or possibly Pledge furniture polish, because they're responsible for having a streak-free glass. And you'd be amazed with a little bit of Pledge, shines it up nice. It looks like a perfectly clean glass. Mm. It'll just have a little bit of a zing, a little lemon zing to it.
You also describe, I don't know if this was alleged or actual, prostitutes using hotels to meet clients. And I'm quoting here, hotels, the brothels of today.
Oh, without a doubt, especially in Manhattan. You know, the bars is a great place to see them. They're always there. They're looking for high price gets there, and they're going to find that in a hotel. You've got business travelers with a lot of money on the road all the time, maybe married, maybe not married, and this anonymous room. So you start in the bar. Otherwise, you know, you order it from a service, and a good prostitute is not going to come to the front desk. Mm. They go right up to the room number. They knock on the door. They go in. They leave, and no one has any idea that a prostitute had come and gone. So, yeah, absolutely. It's rampant. I think when they first opened hotels, that's been one of the reasons for them. And it's a long tradition, and it continues as subtly as possible.
So are there any secrets at a hotel?
Are there any secrets?
Yeah.
That building is made of secrets. as a front desk agent, I was in charge of people's secrets. Or, you know, like I would check in, for example, a businessman, and I've known him for 2-3 years, and this is his New York mistress. Never put her name on the room, but I always was aware of her so that I could give her a key if he wasn't there or something like that. And then the next day, here he is back again with his family, and I'm putting his wife's name on the reservation and keeping my mouth shut about how much I know about what he does during the week, and you know that, and then take that and multiply it, because everyone's got secrets and everyone's got, there's a lot of alternate lifestyles out there, and hotels are the home of anonymity, and that's one of their functions in society. So I think people use it for that, and they'll never stop using it for that. And I was eyewitness to all of it.
Sure. I mean, places to have sex, right?
Absolutely. Whatever you want. I mean, people use a hotel to, commit suicide. They use a hotel to propose. They use a hotel to practice alternate lifestyles, drugs, try to be an artist. You know, these are places where people can go and disappear and reemerge during their time there as whatever they'd like to be. Again, that covers the entire breadth of humanity, and people want to be a lot of different things. And the hotel provides them with that ability.
You have a whole section on tipping. And one of the things that surprised me, and I, having been a waitress, I pride myself on being a very generous tipper. But to be honest with you, Jacob, I didn't know it made sense to tip the receptionist, or I guess the person that signed you in at a hotel. Can you set me straight on that?
Sure. I mean, it's not a tipped position, but in fact, that's why it's so effective when you do tip them, because they're getting a decent hourly wage. But if you offer a little of gratuity to the front desk agent, it's going to go a little bit farther than it would. It's very normal to tip a bellman or a doorman. The most important part about this is that the front desk agent is a very powerful position. It's undervalued and it's underrated. All that typing, it means something. We are the ones deciding your life at the hotel. We're picking your room. We're in charge of your bill. We're going to tell you, no, you can't have a late checkout. We're going to say things like, there's nothing I can do, and you know that all the rooms are the same size, and it's really not true. There's a lot of variation, and there's an incredible amount that a front desk agent can do. So a well-placed gratuity at the right time can get you everything you want.
And what's the right time?
Right at the beginning. You know, that's that when, you know, you spoke about being a waitress. It's a sad thing to tip at the end because, you know, obviously the origin of tipping is, you know, to ensure proper service or whatever. And so it's always better, especially with housekeeping as well. Tip up front. Don't promise that you'll take care of them. If you take care of them right away, then now they feel obligated. If you give me $10, $20, I will do what I can because I feel like I need to earn it. Any decent human being is going to be like, oh, well, now I need to earn this money. And they will. There's a thousand ways that we can feel that we've earned it. And even if it's as simple as smiling at you and thinking you're a kind person and remembering your name and welcoming you back and asking you how the meeting went and, you know, asking you, if you saw a play or where you ate, you know, you're traveling and it can be a hotel can be a lonely place. So simply just having someone who knows your name and who has your back, that right there can improve your stay. And then it just goes on from there.
You write a funny thing when, I guess, tipping the person at the desk. It's not a drug deal that you don't have to do it surreptitiously. You can do it, you know, openly and honestly.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I had the people would give me awkward handshakes. You know, I call it the crinkly handshake, which is nice. You know, you shake someone's hand and it's crinkly. It's nice. But, you know, people just folding down 20s really small and just real awkward handshakes. And it's really not a drug deal. And it really is a good look. I can't imagine. I've never looked at someone while they were giving someone money and been like, thought poorly of that person. Mostly, you look really good doing that. You're like, oh, that guy's giving money. He's a nice guy. Like, wow, that guy's cool. You know what I mean? It really is a sophisticated, generous way to behave.
You describe Bellman as the hotel. So everyone comes and goes, but the Bellman stays. How come?
It's a lucrative position, and the bellmen tend to be born and raised in that city. For some reason, you'll have someone who loves that town and knows everything about that town, and they'll hold down that job for a long, long time. I saw a lot of real tightened-up seniority issues. You can come back 5-10 years, and they may have changed the carpets. They may have, you know, updated the chandeliers. You may be looking at a completely new management staff or front desk staff, but chances are the bellmen and the doorman as well are going to be the same faces, and they're going to have a love for that property and a history that's hard to erase. And in that way, they create the permanent face of a hotel.
And do they make a good living?
They do. It's a great position. You know, I was offered that position at one time, and I was instructed to be wary because if I felt I was going to make a career in the business, taking that step towards Bellman, people, once you get there, the money cut that you have to take to go back into management is so substantial that most people don't take it. So it becomes a career position. Nothing about it is easy. You know, working, if you can imagine, 20, 30 years working as a bellman, you're going to have knee problems, hip problems, elbow problems, shoulder problems, feet problems. You're on your feet all day. So there's, you know, it's a physically demanding job.
Tell us about key bombing. What is that?
I'm still waiting for another front desk agent to come out and say they've done this. Otherwise, I invented it. But when you check in, you're supposed to get two keys, initial keys, that are tied together. So when you get up to the room, you put them in and the lock reprograms itself and both those keys will work. So what I would do, sometimes at the request of a bellman or, you know, if a guest was being rude or whatever, then I would key bomb them and I give them two initial keys. So what happens there? They take both keys up to their room. Whichever key they put in will work and reprogram the lock to function with that key. But the second key is also an initial key. So, you know, at any given point, chances are they're going to put that second key in there. And when they do that, the first key becomes invalid as it's been reprogrammed with the second initial key. So, and then fast forward, you know, another hour or two, and they'll be using that first key in the lock, getting the red light, and find themselves with a demand to come back down to the desk and get new keys, which I could, again, program incorrectly.
And what would someone do in order for you to get that revenge on them?
Any number of things. You know, like Bellman would request it. Anybody making like racist or homophobic comments, you know, yelling at the cab driver, yelling at their daughter, being rude to their wife, being on their cell phone the whole time. Just a thousand things that just little nitpicky situations. Sometimes I didn't know. I'd just have a bellman come up to me like, yo, key bomb this guy. And I'd be like, no problem. You know, wow. I didn't even need to know what his reasoning was. You know, I trusted his judgment and, you know, I'd throw out a key bomb.
You write about housekeepers, and while they often are accused of stealing, they're more likely not to be stealing. Or if they're doing something, they might be just snooping around and looking at your stuff.
Yeah, that was one of my biggest pet peeves at the front desk, was immediately accusing the housekeeper. They know they're under the gun for this. They know they're in your room and they're responsible for your personal items. And if something goes missing, they're the first one that gets leveled at for that kind of accusation. I used to hate that because they're very hardworking people. Mm-hmm. That's definitely the most physically demanding job in the hotel. And, you know, almost 99.9% of the time, the guest didn't bring that pair of earrings, or, you know what I mean, or left something outside of the hotel, you know, lost their iPod, you know, outside. I mean, it's just, but immediately they assume that the housekeeper is stealing it. And really, you know, as far as going through your items, like maybe when you first start, it's kind of that voyeuristic thing, but 2 weeks, 3 weeks on the job, and you could care less about these people's personal items. You're just there to clean the room to the best of your ability and get out of work and go be with your family. So yeah, I used to really dislike that kind of accusation.
Do you miss working in a hotel?
I do. Hopefully that comes out in my voice. It's an incredibly interesting job. It's flexible. There's bad parts about it, obviously. You know, working all of the holidays. You know, I've worked Christmas morning and Thanksgiving afternoon and all of that. But yeah, it's an exciting environment, and I miss my friends. And you know, they're all happy for me and proud of me. But when you're not in the crew, you're not in the crew. I mean, they'll forever have me in their hearts, but. You know, unless I'm standing behind that desk, you know, I'm not part of the team, and it makes me sad.
So has your view of hotels changed now? Jacob Tomsky joined me in 2013 to discuss his best-selling memoir, Heads in Beds. When we get back, we'll listen to my interview with former member of the Supremes, Mary Wilson. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We turn now to my conversation with Mary Wilson. She was a founding member of the Supremes, whose song Baby Love earned them their first Grammy nomination 50 years ago. When I was a teenager, I used to sing into my hairbrush in front of my mirror, trying in vain to move and sound like this famous girl group. The Supremes broke many barriers for women and for people of color. Their elegant style and tight harmonies garnered 12 number one hits and has earned them the title of America's most successful vocal group. Mary Wilson joined me in the studio a couple of years ago, and here's a portion of that conversation. I remember so vividly being a teenager, listening to the Supremes, you know, trying to look and act like the Supremes, not particularly successful as a white girl. Mm-hmm. But did you have any idea at that time the kind of impact your music was having across the country?
Well, you know, it came in stages. In the 60s, when we started, there were very few women, hardly any women around the world who were executives like they are now, or like yourself. There were no female DJs. Women were not in the workplace unless they were just subservient. So a lot of things have changed. And then the most important thing to us was that there were very few black people or black women in those areas. So when we started becoming very famous, we did realize that, hey, this is, you know, we're moving. It's like that. What's that TV show, Moving On Up?
Sure.
And so, you know, we knew that we were different. Our parents had, you know, raised us and tell us to be very careful out there because, you know, you're not da-da and you got to be, everything you do, it's got to be perfect because you will be judged on that. So, you know, we were very, very aware that we had become into a different position, that the civil rights movement was really in full swing in the mid-60s there. So we were one of the ones who knew that. I remember when Martin Luther King was shot, and we all went to the, you know, the funeral, and it was massive. All of the entertainers who were there, you know, the Sammy Davises, Harry Belafonte, you know, just everyone was there. And so we were aware that we were in that movement at the front, on the front lines there. And, you know, we had to have our best foot forward, as our parents always said.
Well, I was looking at some old YouTube videos of some of those early performances, and you were also extremely glamorous.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, how important was that, even as a group, to look as good as you did?
Well, you know, that's something that we didn't think about at first, okay? It was just the way we came, let's put it that way. And we grew up in families where, and the community where the black women were very well dressed. I mean, they were sharp, okay, in his face. Our
aunts, no grungy blue jeans.
Our aunts and moms and, you know, they were all, if you would go to church, I mean, it was quite an array of beauty. Everyone dressed to the nines, whatever it was. And, yeah, so glamour was something that we grew up around. We had role models like Lena Horne. That's who our parents, our moms, looked up to. And so, therefore, it was in our household. I recall when I was about 8, I think it was, I dressed up in my aunt's clothes. And my aunt was a very small lady. And so she had bought all of these new outfits to go on this, I think it was a cruise. And in those days, for a black person going on a cruise, that was a big deal. I think it was just around Detroit, river there,
but anyway, but nonetheless a cruise.
She had all these beautiful outfits, and I decided to have a tea party because every day I would see her come in and look at the dresses and dress up, you know, and look in the mirror and all those kind of things. So I did the same thing when she went to work because my aunt and uncle raised me. When she came home and found all the dresses, like, really messed up. We had stuffed them back in the closet in a whole bit, thinking we had done the right thing at 8 years old. And my aunt went berserk. She said, you're screaming all over the house. And so my uncle, who actually is my dad, I mean, he raised me as my dad, he said, Maymay, I'm going to have to give you a spanking because she's not going to want to go on the cruise, and you're going to make my life a wreck the rest of the year. And da-da-da. And true enough, I mean, I got the beating of my life.
Oh, really?
But I mean, I got, it wasn't tea. We had watermelon, right? It was a tea party, me and my dolls and a whole bit. So I was always, you know, dressing up.
You were actually born in Mississippi, grew up in Detroit, and so what kind of music did you grow up listening to?
Oh, are you kidding? We grew up listening to R&B and gospel, because everyone sang in the choir. I mean, I never did, I don't think. Yeah, we listened to R&B. I remember Bill Williams was one of the first records I recall. Oh, one of my favorite records was Jim Dandy to the Rescue. Go, Jim Dandy. Go, Jim Dandy. Jim Dandy on the mountaintop, 20,000 feet to drop. And so, you know, we listened to the music that our families and all listened to.
And did someone say to you, hey, you've got a really good voice?
No. But I was in all of the glee clubs, the choirs, the ensemble. I remember in kindergarten, or maybe the first grade, I was in one of the earlier, you know, musical groups, and we went on a field trip, which was the Ford Auditorium, I think it was, and I remember all the choirs from around Detroit were there, and so ever since then, I became a member of all of the musical groups.
You became friends with Florence Ballard.
It's kind of a long story, so I'll try to make it short.
Okay.
But in elementary school, they had a talent show. Not judging or anything like that, just a show. If you wanted to be on it, you could do it, and we did. I did, and Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers were on TV, and I saw them. So I thought I'd go on this show at school and just imitate them. And I did, you know, put their music on, and I was just mimicking whatever, and the crowd was going crazy. And then Florence, whom I didn't really know, went up and sang Ave Maria.
Your group was the Primettes, I guess, in the beginning before it evolved into the Supremes.
Yes, after Florence asked me about if I wanted to join a group, which she did like a month after we had met, and she said some guys had come over to her house, one of which I think was dating her sister or something like that, and they had this group going called the Primes. So she was supposed to get a couple of girls, and she told them about me. Then when Diane lived across the street, whom I didn't really know at all at that time, So these guys asked us if we could sing, and we didn't really know each other that well. We had never really sang together anything, but singing was the new thing in the projects. And we said, yeah, okay, sure. And so we went to their apartments, which had our parents known at the time, they would have killed us. But we did, and the guys put us together. Now, what's unique about the story is that two of the guys went on to become two members of the Temptations.
Oh, wow.
That was Eddie Kendricks and Paul Williams. And so we went to their apartments, and they put us together with another girl, Betty McGlon, and that's how we started out as the Primettes. So for, next couple of years, we sang around Detroit at the record hops and this and that, and the DJs were the rage. They could make or break a record or whatever. And so we just did that for a couple of years, and eventually we got the book and said, hey, we're singing with all these people who are recording. Why don't we think of recording? And that's when we went to Motown Records, and we were turned down.
I was going to say, I was reading that Barry Gordy turned you down.
Yeah,
how
yeah.
come?
Well, we didn't find out really how come until years later, and we figured it out. Initially, I think after we auditioned, and we did a great job, too. I mean, we really did a fabulous job. He said, well, come back and see me after you graduate from high school.
Too young?
Yeah, too young. But we didn't know that then. We were like, I remember Florence saying, well, he can't be that great if he doesn't know how good we are. Now, we're only about 15 years old by this time, right? But eventually, we wormed our way into Motown by just going there every day and hanging out. And pretty soon they signed us. And then, of course, when we went there, Mr. Gordy, he said he would sign the contract on us, but he didn't like our name. Primettes. And so Florence came up with the name Supremes.
The studio there was referred to, or at least I read, was referred to as the Snake Pit. Was that a name that...
Well, we were ladies. We never used anything like that.
Oh, okay.
But I'm told that that's kind of what the people, the musicians and the writers who all work there on a daily basis, I think that's something that they did say. We knew it as Studio A. Right now, people come from around the world to see this building, and it is a small little place, and we called it Studio A. Studio A.
But I'm sure looking at it now, it seems like
a little,
and push buttons and
very
analog.
They've left it the same.
Yeah.
They really, it's a landmark now, and they've left it the same as it was, which is really quite kind of nice. One little recorder type thing.
Amazing.
Yes, yes.
Holland, Dozier and Holland wrote a lot of your hit songs.
Yes. And, there were loads of writers and producers there whom we worked with early on, Smokey Robinson being one of the Miracles, people like Bicky Stevenson, who did a lot of things with Stevie Wonder. You had a whole bunch of wonderful writers. But what happened was after we released about six or seven records, Mr. Gordy said, I see you girls are really serious, so I'm going to put you with one of my top writing teams. And that's when he assigned Holland Dozier and Holland, who actually are two brothers, Eddie and Brian Holland, and Lamont Dozier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then that's when we had five consecutive number ones. And then all totaled, I think there were, that the Hollands did, were 10 number ones. Wow. And then we had a couple more by other people. So 12 number one million selling records. And in the 60s, that was quite big.
Indeed. And there's this up-and-coming group, the Supremes, with five consecutive number one songs.
Well, yes, and it was just great. We started touring all over the world. We did command performances with the royal family in England. We started wearing these gorgeous gowns and touring the world and hanging out with royalties. It was just a fun time. And England has still been one of my favorite places. Great Britain was where we really became very famous. Even now, we're like their children. I remember the first time we landed in England, we were on the cover of every front newspaper, and one of the papers said, three black negresses have just landed on the shores of Great Britain. And we're like, where? But, that was the tone. So we kind of really introduced, black was beautiful. You had your other wonderful ladies, Josephine Baker and all who had gone there, but here are three.
Yes.
Three. And the music business was so new, and we were accepting the Beatles here. So you had that opening, the boundaries were torn down, and then this music came through. And like you said, you grew up and you had the hairbrushes and all
totally.
That stuff.
In the mirror. Do all the moves.
I remember one lady said she had the vacuum cleaner hose. But yeah.
Or deodorant. I mean, there are many things you can hold in your
hands.
And
when I do my shows, which I do quite often, you know, women come up on stage and they say, you know, and it's all, now it's all colors. Because you remember before, on some of the album covers, they couldn't even have black faces on them, you know, because it just wasn't, you know, white folks didn't look at that. To look at the black faces. And so one time we were working in Eden Rock at, it was in Florida. And I think it was Eden Rock or Fountain Blue Hotel. And this Jewish lady came up to me and she says, you know, when you girls are on Ed Sullivan's show, I allow my family to watch you all the time. So my brother, who was like a black militant type guy, right? He's like, Mary, what the does she mean by she allows her family to watch us? You know, but that's the way it was back then. And, you know, thankfully, you know, we were part of that, helping the change and seeing that black was beautiful, as James Brown said.
Indeed.
I'm black and I'm beautiful.
There are always those stories of you know, people who grew up in modest surroundings. All of a sudden, they become famous and they can't deal with it. Was fame a hard thing for you to deal with?
I love being out there. But, you know, it's an individual thing.
Right.
I mean, it really depends on who you are as an individual. Many people do not like being away from home. They don't like traveling. They don't like different...
The spotlight, even?
I love people. I love, as I've gotten older, though, I'm a bit more closed than I used to be. I guess because I know people more now, and I know that there are deep, dark secrets that people carry around. But when I was growing up, for me, it would just gave me this opportunity to, because I always read fairy tale books when I was younger, and I was always alone. My aunt and uncle worked two and three jobs, and so I was alone a lot, and I would just sit there and fantasize. So for me, the traveling and being out there kind of brought to me what I always wanted to know, what's going on out there in the world. Mm-hmm. Some people just, it's not made for them, and they don't like people, or they're bashful, you know, so they don't care for all of that. It really is an individual thing.
And it can be hard on the group because you're living and traveling so much together as well.
Well, yeah, any group of people, you know, you have your differences.
Sure.
Let's face it, there are just things that you just don't agree with. It doesn't mean that you don't like the people, things of that nature.
The group finally did, I guess, disband.
Yeah, after a while. You know what? Let me see. Flo was no longer in the group by certain adverse situations.
Yeah, she had a tough time.
She really did. She had a personal tragedy happen to her. And as we were talking about taboos earlier, she actually was abused by a neighborhood person. It totally destroyed her.
People and kept it secret?
Yes, because it wasn't the time. People didn't talk about those kind of things then. Even the people at Motown didn't really know what had happened to her. All they knew is that now she was just acting strange and acting different, and then later on she started drinking. But people don't realize that those kind of things eat away at you so badly that you do have this fear of life and of people. And that's kind of what happened to Flo. So I knew that I was talking out of turn or whatever when I told the world about what had happened to Flo. But I wanted them to understand that that wasn't the real person that I knew. It was that she was tormented. And she was trying to, you try to hide your pain or cure that pain that you're feeling. So that's kind of what happened to her.
She had so much charisma. I mean, you could
see
Flo
that.
Oh, you
know, Flo was a character.
Flo
was a real, real character. And I just loved it. She was bubbly. If she laughed. Everybody laughed around her. She had a Santa Claus laugh, you know. But yeah, so, you know, those she left, then Flo left, Diane left. And I was the only person there. And then Berry Gordy brought in Jean Terrell, which was really wonderful because Jean has a great voice. And she was able to now carry on in Diane's spot. And bring us more hit records. Stone Love, Up the Ladder to the Roof, Everybody's Got the Right to Love, Floyd Joy. So, you know, we had a career after Flo and Diane, which for me was not very good because it was another group.
Yes.
It wasn't the same group. It wasn't the three of us who dared to dream back in the 60s, who went through those, drank out of those colored water fountains, who were on the Ed Sullivan shows like 16 times. You know, it wasn't the same girls who had dared to dream and made our dreams come true.
And that was Mary Wilson, founding member of the legendary group The Supremes. And that wraps up this edition of Radio Times in Review. Please email us and tell us what you think of the show. Our address is radiotimes@whyy.org. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for listening.